Well, last year was the 40th anniversary of the 1968 events, and on the TV and the radio and in magazines, there were quite a few commemorative articles about those events. And I must say it was quite an irritating and frustrating time, because while there were some very good documentaries put out on some TV channels, it must be said that most of the coverage of the events, or you know, the documentaries about 1968, gave the general impression that most of the documentaries, commemorating the events, you could be forgiven for thinking that May 1968 was all about, women taking the pill, or the right not to wear a bra, or the right to sneak into the dormitory of the opposite sex in the universities. It was presented in a very kind of superficial way as a kind of social liberation movement, or a moral liberation movement. And that was extremely unfortunate, because the reality of 1968 was it was the biggest general strike in the history, in European history anyway. There's been bigger general strikes in the Third World, but in European history it's the biggest, most powerful and longest general strike in European history. It lasted overall for over a month. And it really shook French society to its very foundations. Something like 11 million workers on strike, if you take into account their families and the people who depend upon them. And also, you take into account that a large part of these 11 million workers were workers in the key industries in the country. So the effect of this general strike was to completely paralyze the economy. And it really showed what socialists have always maintained, that the working class is society in many ways. You know, you might know this phrase from the French Revolution, where the ABC said that about the third estate. He said the third estate, meaning the bourgeoisie and the labouring classes and so on, were everything, and what they were considered as nothing. And I think that's even more true of the working class today. I mean, we still hear a lot of professors saying the working class is disappearing, it doesn't really amount to much in society. Well, the reality is that everything in society is really carried out, all the essential functions of society are carried out by the working class. And when the working class stops working, that's when people notice that it exists and how powerful it is. And that was really demonstrated in an extremely striking manner in 1968. Now, it's true that those events took place after quite a long period of economic expansion, which in some countries like Britain, Germany, the northern European countries in general, it was a period of relative social calm, social peace. But it wasn't the case everywhere. For instance, we should remember that at that time there were military dictatorships in power in Spain, in Portugal, in Greece, and in Turkey, and in other countries too in the Western world. And in France itself, in 1958, there was a military coup which took place, which was launched from Algeria by extreme right-wing generals who launched a bid to take power in Paris and install a military dictatorship. And it's on the basis of that attempted coup that General de Gaulle came to power in that year, in 1958. The parliament, the Fourth Republic, the parliamentary regime which existed until 1958, just collapsed like a pack of cards. The MPs basically, put a few belongings in their suitcases and ran away in the face of a military coup. And de Gaulle stepped into the breach and took power on the basis of those events. So that in France, even though there was a general, quite a strong development of the French economy, and it must be said, overall, quite a significant increase in living standards for the mass of the population because of the growth in the economy, the growth in world trade, which characterized that period. Nonetheless, it was a period of great social and political instability in France, and 1968 was a kind of culmination of a whole series of quite important strikes and factory occupations which took place during the 1960s. For instance, in 1963, there was a major general strike in the public services and in the nationalised industries like coal and steel, which was a kind of a forewarning of what was coming up in 5 years later in 1968. Now, one of the consequences of the economic development in the country was to strengthen and renew the French working class. And compared to Britain, France was developed very late from the point of view of industry. There's quite a remarkable statistic that the year in Britain in which half of the population was in the towns and half the population was in the countryside is 1761 because of the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, on the basis of quite a small population, it's true at that time. But the year in France when half the population is in the towns and half in the countryside is 1934. And in the time of the Second World War, there was something like that, 50-55% of the population were in the towns. By 1968, it was 85% of the population that was working in that were wage workers and working mainly in industry and related activities. And now, for instance, in modern day France, only 5% of the population work in agriculture, and of those 5%, 85% are wage workers. So you can see there's been over the second half of the last century, there was a kind of huge sweeping development which massively increased the power and preponderance of the wage working population in relation to the rest of society. So that was part also of the preparation for the events of 1968. I would say also that in spite of the fact that there was quite a boom in industry with the development of the motor car industry and all the industries related to the consumerism of the 50s and 60s, refrigerators, TVs, cars, the washing machines and that kind of thing, that was done to a large extent at the expense of the working conditions of the industrial working class in particular. It was not unusual to find people working 50, 55 hours a week. Wages, there was a minimum wage of sorts, but it was extremely low. In order to drive down wages, the main industrial bosses in France had gone over into Algeria and into Morocco and into Tunisia, where there are films of this, where you see representatives of a company like Peugeot, where they go into a village in Morocco, and it's literally like a sort of a slave market, where they kind of feel people's muscles and look at their teeth like you do to expect the health of a horse, And there'd be a kind of selection of people, and they'd be offered a job in France, which of course was a way for them of getting out of the misery of their villages in Morocco. And they'd be brought into the factories, not speaking the language, brought into the factories in France in order to be put into competition with the French workers and keep wages down and kind of divide the workers up on racial and national lines. So there's in spite of the growth in the economy, there's a very kind of reactionary policy on the part of the capitalists with very tight control over the TV and the radio, where basically the news in the evening and all the kind of political content of TV shows was strictly controlled by the Ministry of the Interior. As well as the police and the army, there was an organization called the Service National Civique, or Civic Action Service, which is a very nice name, is it not? You think there might be, ambulance men or Red Cross workers or something. But in fact, it's a paramilitary organization which was involved in kidnapping, assassination, gun running, and so on, and was officially the kind of personal bodyguard of General de Gaulle, but was involved in beating up and even assassinating trade unionists and communists and people who were opposed to the government. One of the leaders of that organization is Charles Pasqua, who is still alive today and has played a particularly reactionary role in various right-wing governments. So that's a general political background to the events of 1968. You can see that given the fact that there was this pressure on working conditions, pressure on wages, huge inequalities developing in society, not a dictatorship, but a parliamentary Bonapartist regime of General de Gaulle, in other words, kind of semi-dictatorial regime with a kind of parliament playing just a kind of rubber stamp role to the dictates of the executive, the government and the executive. And this was so much combustible material accumulating in French society, and which finally spilled out onto the surface in 1968. Now, students and the middle classes are very often a kind of a barometer of the mood in society in general. Very often students can go on strike or occupy universities more kind of spontaneously and more easily than workers can move into action, for the simple reason that, you know, if there's a student strike, you don't lose your wages kind of thing. And it's easier for students to take action than it is for workers. Well, when a worker goes on strike, in spite of what is said, very often, you know, workers strike for the drop of a hat and so on. In fact, it's a very serious decision because it means very big sacrifices for workers, and they've got it's an awful lot of psychological and material pressure on workers to organise a strike and carry it through with a reasonable chance of success. With the students, they're a bit more of a volatile section of society because of the conditions of life and work. And therefore, even when there's kind of a lot of resentment and pressure and anger rising up in the working class, sometimes it's expressed not immediately by action by the workers themselves, but among these layers of society which are kind of sensitive to the mood of the workers and the mood arising in society as a whole. It's often the students who are the first ones to move into action. And that was the case here. We had in the universities quite a lot of agitation, particularly in the universities with a higher proportion of students from a working class background, particularly the University of Nanterre, which is not far from Paris, on the western side of Paris. And in 1968, Nanterre University, it was kind of built up very quickly, a bit haphazardly, not very well equipped. And Nanterre University was kind of half surrounded by what the French call a bidonville, which is a kind of a shanty town of immigrant workers who had no proper housing, the poorest sections of society who couldn't afford to live in Paris. They would go and live in these corrugated iron huts and tents and things all around Nanterre University. So that obviously coloured the political thinking and the general political atmosphere in that particular university. The way things happened, and there was also a lot of agitation and demonstrations, protest meetings about the Vietnam War, about all kinds of social issues, racism and so on, which were going around in society at that time. And what really put the spark to to things in Nanterre was that an extreme right-wing organization, a fascist organization called Occident, issued a leaflet basically threatening Nanterre students that if they kept organising demonstrations, complaining about Vietnam, complaining about the goal and so on, then they would teach them a lesson. And students know what that means, because these fascist gangs were organised with iron bars, you know, with baseball bats and things, and sometimes even with firearms, and they would just descend on a demonstration and beat people up and sometimes cause very serious injury. So as a reaction to this threat, there was a demonstration against the extreme right wing organised in Nanterre. And of course the police then turned up, the famous French riot police, with their very brutal methods in order to maintain order. But in fact, instead of it being the little Occident grouping attacking the students, the police directly attacked the students, and in a particularly violent manner. The following day, all the press was full of the condemnation of the violence in the universities, but not the violence of the police, of course, the violence of the students, and in fact it had been a peaceful demonstration, but just a protest against the threats by the ultra-right organisations. And from there, it was like a snowballing of protest and opposition spreading from one university to another. And there were kind of several high points in the student protest. You might have heard of, for instance, on the 6th of May, there was after a battle between the police and the students in the centre of Paris, there were 600 students wounded. That gives an idea of the scale of that battle. You've probably seen films of this, with cars turned over and on fire and trees pulled down and barricades erected in the streets of the city. 600 wounded and 422 arrested. And then on the 10th of May, there was what has gone down in history as the night of the barricades, because there were 60 barricades set up in the Sorbonne area, just near the city centre in Paris, around the Sorbonne University. And there again, particularly vicious repression by the police, for instance, as these students were being, you know, having their skulls broken basically by the police, they'd be taken away in ambulances to the hospitals. There's a big hospital just near the Sorbonne called Hôtel Dieu. So the ambulances would come and pick up the wounded students, take them into this local hospital, and the police would follow the ambulances into the hospital, and then when the wounded were on their stretchers and so on, they'd take them off and carry them off to the police stations where they'd get further off treatment. And it was really a huge pitch battle between the youth of Paris and the forces of repression. And so that, as it went on for a fortnight, started to have an electrifying effect on the rest of society. All this accumulated anger and discontent about the Gaullist regime, about the exploitation in the workplaces, about social inequality and racism, poor housing conditions, all the rest of it. You know, people felt enormous sympathy with the students, and the trade union leaders and the leaders of the Communist Party, the socialist leaders, who kind of stood back from all these events and not taken any initiative. In fact, the Communist Party roundly condemned the students and denounced them as basically middle-class pansies, you know, that nobody should support. And agents provocateurs, you know, people who were really working for the bosses to try and provoke the workers into premature action. This was the attitude of the Communist Party. You can see all this in the archives of the CP paper, L'Humanité. You know, it was a very kind of, it was a line not very far from the line which the government was taking in relation to the students. They played no part in these events in the universities. But they started to come under enormous pressure from the rank and file for some kind of solidarity action to show that the workers were on the student side in this in these battles against the police. And so finally, on the 13th of May, that's 3 days after this night of the barricades, the main trade unions in France organized a one-day general strike in solidarity with students and to protest against the repression. And they clearly saw it as just a kind of a safety valve. Okay, the workers want a demonstration, we'll give them a demonstration, and then we'll say we've done our piece, and everybody will go back to work, and sooner or later the student movement will fizzle out, especially because it will soon be the summer holidays and so on. That was the attitude of the trade union leaders. And the government itself felt fairly reassured. De Gaulle went away around by that time on a kind of a diplomatic handshaking trip in Romania and so on. So he obviously wasn't, he didn't think things were going to too much get out of hand. But things took a very different course, because the 13th of May, one-day action got massive support. I can't remember exactly who, but I think it was possibly 2 or 3 million participants at that time on the demonstrations and in the on strike. And then, but on the 14th of May, when normally, according to the leadership's plan of things, the workers would just go back to work, having let off some steam. On the 14th of May, quite a few workers stayed out on strike, and there were kind of meetings on street corners and in factories. Some factories were occupied, or the workers were reluctant to go back into the workplace. And so the foreman would come out and say, "Come on, you know, there's no strike today," and so on. And also the CGT and Communist Party officials would be trying to push the workers into the factory, saying, you know, it was a one-day action, we've carried out the action, you know, it's all over now, back to work. But there was obviously a kind of an effervescence in the workplaces. And one particular factory, Sud Aviation, an aircraft factory in Nantes, made a declaration saying they maintained their strike, occupying their factory, and called on the rest of the working class to follow their example. And that call was taken up, first of all, in the automobile industry, and then it spread to other industries. And so if you look at the strike curve from the kind of 13th and 14th of May, you've got the big strike day of action of the 13th of May. Then there's a kind of fall off, but not everybody goes back to work. And then day after day after day, the strike curve just goes up and up and up until we get to this figure of 11 million people. And it wasn't just for working class action. I mean, there's innumerable funny stories about how this kind of revolutionary mood affected all layers in society. You might have heard that the dancers in the Folie Bergère went on strike, that the nuclear research scientists who were working on the atomic bomb in the Sakhalin nuclear plant went on strike. Many of the ministries, like the Ministry of Agriculture, the Ministry of Industry, different ministries like this, the personnel had just, all the administrative staff had just walked out. So you could kind of stroll into the Ministry of Agriculture, have a look in the offices, see what was around. You know, and the CGT, that is the biggest unions, the CFTT, the Communist Party, and kind of workers' activists, they kind of ruled the city. You know, they even celebrated marriages, you know, like, not celebrated yet in English, or what do you say, you know, they carried out marriages, you know, you may now kiss the bride and this kind of thing. In some areas where the shops were closed and where the banks were closed, because nobody could get their hands on money, the unions issued promissory notes, that is to say, you know, like, you know, it says on an English pound, I promise to pay the bearer and so on. So you'd get a kind of CGT certificate saying, you know, saying to a grocer, for instance, this is good money, and the CGT will guarantee that, you know, when things get back to order, you'll get your money back for it. So there's kind of, when you get so many people on strike, of course, society, in a way, we say that the general strike stops society, but no, society never really stops. But what happens here is that the power in society was changing hands. So the workers, instead of just working and having all the decisions and the power and the decision as to what is produced and what happens in the hands of the bosses and the employers and the state and so on, they were starting to take these decisions for themselves. So, for instance, the hospitals would get electricity, but the factories wouldn't get electricity. Little by little, in a situation like this, the working class doesn't necessarily directly fully take power, but it's as if you've got a kind of an embryonic worker state coexisting with what remains of the official state apparatus. And we call that a situation of dual power. It's like the workers have kind of encroached on the power of the capitalist class to a large degree, because they're the ones who decide what is produced, what moves, and what doesn't move. And this wasn't just the French movement either. German workers, German railway workers, for instance, any trains coming from Germany that were going to come through in the plant, the German railway workers stopped every German train on the French frontier. France is on strike. German trains won't break the French railway workers' strike. And what's even more significant is even in Spain, which, let's remember, was under Franco's dictatorship at the time, the truck drivers in Spain had the risk of possible death, and in any case, very long prison sentences and torture and so on, refused to scalp on the French truck drivers who were on strike in 1968. So there was, I think you're getting a general idea, it was a huge uprising of the French working class, a huge movement, where to a large degree, the workers kind of, it's as if they're within grasp of state power. If they'd have had proper leadership and proper, leaders with real perspectives and revolutionary aims, if the leaders of the French workers in those days had really wanted to finish off capitalism, then they could have done it very, very easily. And there are several indications of that. For instance, this organization I mentioned, the Service d'Action Civique, this kind of parallel, paramilitary organization for basically, armed folks, basically, in the pay of the forest regime. General de Gaulle, he planned for the Service d'Action Civique to be used as Pinochet used the army in 1973, 5 years later. The plan was that in the middle of the night, I think this must have been around something like the 23rd or 24th of May, he could feel that the situation was getting out seriously out of control. He's a very astute politician, actually, General de Gaulle. And he, now that we've got the cabinet meeting minutes, you can see that he had a very, very realistic appraisal of the situation. For instance, you see, you can read that he explains to his ministers that he could trust, they could trust the Communist Party. He knew the Communist League as well. He actually says, the Communists are very critical of us and so on. They're nominally our enemies. But he says, every time France has needed to count on it, they've always replied present. You know, and what he meant was, now that we're really in danger, that we can count on the Communist Party leaders to hold the workers back and not let things get too far. But in another cabinet meeting, he's a bit more alarmed, and he explains to the assembled government, he says that the situation is getting so critical that in spite of the Communist Party leaders' opposition to a revolution, they may be forced to take power in spite of themselves. In other words, they might not be able to hold back the movement from below. So he was a very astute politician. He knew what was going on. And as I say, around the 23rd or 24th of May, I can't remember the exact date, but he had this plan where during the night, the Service d'Action Civique and the police and the secret services and so on, all the kind of shadier end of the state, were to move into working class districts during the night, and they had a list of something like 28,000 trade union activists, communists, socialists, student leaders and so on. And the idea was to arrest them during the night and take them away to the winter sports stadium and have them interned in the winter sports stadium. And his idea was, by decapitating the labor movement, and kind of, you know, people would wake up and find that they had no leaders, then that would demoralise the movement, he thought, and kind of stop the curve from rising and get the curve of the general strike to go back down again. Well, there again, de Gaulle proved to be quite astute, because just on the day before this operation was supposed to take place, he cancelled the whole thing, because he realised that things had gone so far by that critical period, really the critical moment of 1968, was kind of last week of May. He realised that if the workers had done that, imagine, you know, when people get up and the news gets out that this has been done, then instead of calming the movement down, that might have turned the general strike into an insurrection, which is completely in line with the revolutionary traditions of the French people, which you probably know something about. And so he kind of drew back from that, and that shows really how weak the French ruling class was, you know. And actually, de Gaulle made a statement to the American ambassador saying that he thought capitalism was finished in France, and that he couldn't hold the line anymore. And the Times, if I'm not mistaken, either the Times or the Financial Times, had a headline saying capitalism is dead, you know, in France. So it was a very critical situation from a capitalist point of view. But unfortunately, in spite of this extremely favourable situation where, as I say, the workers were within reach of transforming society, they could have just, they already occupied most of the factories and so on. All they had to do was kind of have a government which would legalise and officialise this, the power which they actually had in fact. It just had to be legalised and organised by the nationalisation under workers' controls workers' control of this industry, and then they could have started to reorganize society on new lines. But the events of 1968 show us that on the one hand, there's enormous potential power in the hands of workers and students when they act in a concerted fashion to change society and change their conditions. But the other lesson from 1968 is that unless there's a party or an organization with a clear revolutionary policy, with revolutionary aims, with some idea of how, you know, what needs to be done and what does need to be done. Basically, power is two things. It's ownership of the economy and control of arms. Those are the two kind of pillars of power. The ownership of the economy, they could have acquired it relatively easily, as I said, because they actually were de facto the economic power in the country now. And as for the arms power, we saw the limits of that with the gold kind of drawing back at the last minute, and also by the effervescence which was in the armed forces. There's one leaflet here I can quote, for instance, which was distributed at a place called Mutzig near Strasbourg, which is a very conservative area of France, by the way, the Alsace. There's a leaflet given out by the conscripts of the army in that area, and this is what it said. As with all conscripts, we're confined to barracks, says the leaflet. They're preparing to make us intervene as a repressive force. The youth and the workers should know that the soldiers of our contingent will never fire on the workers. We're absolutely opposed to the kind of encirclement of the factories by the army, which was one idea which had been floated. And we must fraternize. Soldiers of the contingent, form your committee. So you can see, if that was the case in Strasbourg, which is a traditional kind of Catholic and very kind of conservative area, you get some idea of what must have been the mood in the barracks around Paris and the big city. So de Gaulle, he also went to Germany to discuss with General Massu, who was a really vicious fascist type, who, you know, would have loved the chance just to fire on the workers and so on. But even Massu, he said he was at the general's disposal, you know, if the general ordered him to intervene, he would do. But then on the side, he said that he strongly advised against it for the same reason, and that might just precisely precipitate the change from a general strike into a revolution. So these two pillars of power, armed power and economic power, the workers could have taken it. But the problem here is that where you've got a party like the French Communist Party or the Socialist Party at the time, and the trade union leaders, who basically had, even though they're called nominally socialists and communists, they'd long since given up any kind of real revolutionary activity. For instance, I mentioned the war in Algeria. On more than one occasion, the Communist Party group in the French Parliament voted the special powers to the generals in Algeria, that is to say, the right to arbitrary arrest, torture, shootings, and so on. They gave them dictatorial powers. The Communist Party voted that. That's not exactly a revolutionary and internationalist policy. And in 1936, the Communist Party leaders had called off a general strike while the numbers of strikers were still increasing. So many, that's what De Gaulle meant when he said every time we've needed them, they've been on call now. And they did the same thing in 1968. And the way this strike kind of finally came to an end and ended in a kind of a semi-defeat, is because where you have the Communist Party saying the situation is not revolutionary. The strikers are putting forward economic demands on wages, for working conditions, for trade union rights. This is how the strike began, and this is how the strike must end. And there can be no question of socialism. Socialism is a second stage. You know, we've always had the Stalinists always had this two-stage theory. First, more democracy, better conditions of life. And the second stage is socialism. There's just one problem with this two-stage theory. The second stage never arrives. There's always the real, substance of the two-stage theory is that it's never the time for socialism. That's what it amounts to. And they have this idea that, you know, we're just in the first stage, no question of socialism. The capitalists must maintain their control of the economy. And they limited the demands of the movement to economic and social and democratic demands. Now, of course, the capitalist class never liked giving anything away. But when they're threatened with losing everything, they'll always make concessions. You know, the trade union leaders like Georges Seguin and Benoît Facon and so on, they went to the negotiations in the Rue de Grenelle at the end of May. You know, they kind of boast about the way things went. They said, this was an amazing negotiation. We'd say, we want 5 hours off the working week. And the Employers Federation would say, agreed. And we want a 20% increase in wages. Agreed. And we want more, rights for shops too. Agreed. And he said, you know, he thinks it's because they're brilliant negotiators. But the fact is the capitalists have got a kind of rope around their neck, getting tighter and tighter. And what they're saying is basically, give them what they want, get the strike called off, and then later, once the strike is called off, we can start to claw these things back. That was their strategy. It was a kind of tactical retreat. But instead of seeing that it was a tactical retreat and warning the workers about that, the communist leaders then went back with these agreements, the Grenelle agreements, as they're called, and said, look at all the advantages we've won. And the amazing thing is that at that stage, the Grenelle agreements, these negotiated agreements, weren't accepted by the workers. When Siggy went to the Renault factory at Billancourt, just outside Paris, we had these dossiers on, the thing under his arm, and he opens it up. He's trying to read out to the workers all the things which have been gained. You can't actually hear what Siggy says, in spite of the fact he's got the microphone, because you've got these, maybe 20,000 workers in the factory, and they're just chanting, as he's trying to speak and announce the reforms we want. He says, this is on film. And they're saying, popular government, by which they mean workers' government. And that shows that the workers themselves felt that this was nothing compared to what they could have. And there's also a very remarkable film, which you can actually download on the internet if you've got EU or one of these things. If you type Wonder, or Wonder Batteries, quite ever-ready batteries, Wonder Batteries, and the factory is in a place called Saint-Ouen. And what happened there was there's a group of students of cinematography had a project of filming social events, and they went to film this the strike at the Wonder Factory in Saint-Ouen. And this was at the time when the Communist Party was, and the CGT leaders were saying to the workers, you all have to go back to work, we've won all that we can win, so now the strike is off. And this is a really remarkable film, because you see the CGT and Communist Party MPs and officials, they turn up at the factory, and these are mainly women workers, and they say, look, we've got this and this and this, you must be responsible, you've got to go back to work. And the women just kind of scream at them and say, do you know what it's like working in here? Do you know, with batteries and so on, there's all kinds of filth that people breathe in, poisonous substances, mercury and lead and so on. Do you know what it's like working in there? And he said, okay, you say we've got this and this and this, but that's nothing compared to what we had. What they meant was we had power, or we thought we had power. And you can actually see women workers breaking down in tears and kind of getting quite hysterical because of what they feel, and they're quite right, as a betrayal. But they're being kind of herded like beasts back into the factory when they know themselves that whatever the employees have agreed to today, once the strike is off, they can take it back tomorrow. So it took about a month for the apparatus of the trade unions and the workers' parties to kind of wind down the strike completely, but that the general strike in 1968 kind of petered out over a period of something like 4 weeks. And that's the way the strike ended, because, workers being practical people, if there's no possibility, no perspective, none of their organisations are actually proposing any kind of fundamental change to society, once they start to feel that opportunity is slipping away, then they will say, well, okay, we'll just accept what's won and go back to work, after all, what else are you supposed to do? So that was the way the strike finally came to an end. Now, that failure to take power, the workers were to pay a very heavy price for it, because just a few years later, there was the first kind of a downturn in the world economy around 1973, 1974, with the appearance of mass unemployment in all European countries. 1 million, 2 million workers unemployed in most countries, rampant inflation. I remember in Britain, I think the inflation rate got into the 20s at one point in the middle of the 70s. A sharp decline in living standards. And it was the same in France, huge unemployment, worsening of the conditions of the workers, and constant attacks on their living standards. And a lot of the gains in 1968 were just effectively eradicated. One of the other effects of 1968 was it had a radicalizing effect, even though the strike was defeated, or let's say it was a semi-defeat. Why a semi-defeat? Because even though the capitalists managed to get the strike called off, in the past, if they'd have defeated the workers in that way, or they'd have avoided a revolutionary overturn, always the French capitalists would send in the army and the police, and they would conduct a massacre. They've done that every time. Or in after 1936, there was a peace regime which collaborated with the Nazis, and you know the consequences of all that. So there was always, in the past, there'd been a kind of a revolutionary movement which didn't come to a revolutionary conclusion, and then there'd be a kind of serious counter-revolution in society. But in 1968, it wasn't quite that. It was a revolutionary movement. It didn't come to a revolutionary conclusion, but the capitalists couldn't really exact their vengeance on the workers in the same way they had in the past, because of the power which the workers had accumulated in society in the intervening period. So it wasn't a kind of catastrophic and demoralizing defeat like some of the defeats of the period before. But nonetheless, it had a radicalizing effect on the thinking, and the ideas of revolution, of Marxism, of socialist change were kind of very widespread and ingrained in the French labor movement as a result of 1968. And that's one of the reasons why the Socialist Party was pushed very much to the left in the following years, included in its program the nationalization of the economy and the overthrow of capitalism. Mitterrand, for instance, who had been a right-wing politician in the previous period. There's a film of him at the Epinay conference in 1971. He says, well, there's been some discussion here about whether the revolution should be peaceful or violent. He said, I don't want to get into all that, but what I will say is anyone who isn't for a socialist revolution has no place in this room. And we know what Mitterrand came to later. But the fact that such a kind of moderate politician as Mitterrand was forced to speak like that to gain any credibility gives some idea of the mood in society at that time. So maybe you should hold a meeting sometime about what happened under the left government of 1981 when Mitterrand finally came to power. But I would just finish by saying that 1968 still is a kind of reference point for the French left today. And it's more than just an ideological reference point, but just a few years ago, there was a series of events which were like, it was like the unwinding of the film, or the reeling of the film of 1968, or the first stages of it, when the government tried to introduce this first employment contract, which you might hear of, which meant that until the age of 25 or 26, contracts could be broken without any justification. As to say, you're employed today, tomorrow they say go home, you just go home. If the employer didn't even have to give a reason for why you were sacked. And there's, you know, basically turning the youth into a mass of, you know, raw material for exploitation, basically. And the movement which took place in the schools and universities against this thing took on huge proportions, and pressure was building once again for the unions to move in and call a general strike. And the capitalists could see that this was a reminder of them. You know, they started thinking, haven't we seen this somewhere before? And finally, they just withdrew the law in order to defuse the situation. But, you know, if they hadn't withdrawn the law, it could have been a replay of 1968. So we can't predict, when revolutionary developments of this kind will take place.
Can you make a comment, please?
But what you can say is that the whole kind of social and economic context in France at the present time is kind of favours the emergence of movements of this kind. I mean, there's not a single domain, whether it be housing, social security, wages, you know, health, education, where society is going forward. We're kind of being dragged back in all these fields, and no society can continue on that basis indefinitely. And so we can't say exactly what form things will take or to what extent it will be a repetition of the kind of events we saw in 1968, but you can see that the kind of new revolutionary perspective is something which is implicit in the whole social and economic situation which exists at the present time. And our job is to try and replace that missing factor in 1968, to create that. That is to say, within the CGT, within the Communist Party, within the Socialist Party, group together those elements which are prepared to stand on a firm revolutionary platform and in that way, if we do have a repetition of events like 1968, this time we'll be able to pose a serious alternative to the conciliatory and treacherous policy.